Okay, good morning, everyone. For those of you who I haven't seen, Happy New Year. I'd like to start with a roll call so we know who is on the line. I'll start with board members. I'm Peter Lisi. Do we have Marty Budd? Marty? Not yet. Andrew Foster?
Present.
Thank you. Steve Kittowitz?
Present.
Thank you. Daryl Hill? Daryl? Julie Savino? Julie? Jeanette Weldon?
I see Julie just popped on.
I'm here, yes.
Julie, are you on? Ben Barnes? Do we have Ben Barnes? All right. Let's go over Chief Chesil staff. Denise Aguilera?
Present.
Thank you. Kevin Berry? Kevin? Deb Galley?
Here.
Thank you. Dan Junji?
Present.
Dan, was that you? Yes.
Yes, Dan Junji is present.
Thank you. Josh Herlock?
I'm here.
Thank you. Carly Levin?
Here.
Joanne Makowitz?
I'm here.
Thank you. Cynthia Peoples?
Here.
Thank you. Shannon Reynolds? Shannon? Natalia Rosio?
I'm here.
Thank you. Kara Stewart?
Here.
All right. And one more time on board members, do we have Marty Budd?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Thank you, Marty.
Yes.
And Julie Savino, Julie, did you join?
Yes, I did. I'm here.
Thank you. Ben Barnes? All right, still no Ben. All right. Consultants and advisors, I'm going to call out your name. If you're on the line, please signify your presence. Joe Santoro? Joe Santoro? All right. Judith Blank?
I am here.
Thank you. Namita Shah? No? Glenn Rabacki? No? Ben McGuire? Is that a yes to Ben McGuire?
No, Ben McGuire is not on the call, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So Tim, will you be a sole rep for Hilltop Securities?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Jeff Wagner on?
Yes, I'm here.
Gary Wolf?
Yeah, good morning. I'm here.
Thank you. Melissa Vachon? Melissa? No? Lou DeLuca? Matt Rosen?
I'm here.
Is that Matt?
Yes.
Thank you. And from BLX, Sandy Stallings?
I'm here.
And Richard Charles?
Yes, good morning.
Thank you. Is there anyone whose name I didn't call that is participating on the call?
Hi, Brian Karras from RBC is on the call.
Okay, thank you.
And Tyler Walker from Amtech?
Can we do it one at a time? Who else? Anyone else?
It was Ray Bentley from Amtech, and I'm not sure who the other person was.
Tyler Walker from RBC is up on.
Did you get Ben Barnes too?
No, I didn't, but if Ben is on, that's great. Thank you.
Shannon from Chesil is here as well.
Okay. All right, I think we've got the roll call all set for the minutes. And speaking of minutes, first item of business is the approval from the November 5th meeting. Hopefully folks have had a chance to review them. Is there a motion to accept the minutes as presented?
So moved.
Thank you, Marty. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Steve. We have a motion and a second to accept the minutes from November 5th. Are there any corrections or edits? Any clarifications that need to be made on the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes as presented, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you, minutes pass. Next item of business is a report on the internal audit, and I believe the folks from BLX are going to walk us through that. So I'll turn it over to them.
And actually, before turning it over to Sandy and Richard, I just wanted to give the context of this discussion, which is just to clarify. So the Audit Finance Committee of the Chief of Board engages with outside firms, as you know, to conduct internal audits. And in the past, the CHESLA board has heard from Barry Dunn, who is one of those contractors that does internal audits. In the case of arbitrage rebate audit, the Chief Audit Finance Committee engaged with BLX after an RFP process to undertake an audit of CHIFA arbitrage rebate calculations as well as CHESLA arbitrage rebate calculations. And BLX was brought in, was to be used instead of Barry Dunn because BLX has specific expertise in this area. They were selected after the RFP process and they are an active service provider with regard to these types of calculations with clients who are bond issuers across the country. But last week, BLX presented its audit reports on both CHIFA and CHESLA to the Audit Finance Committee of the CHIFA Board. And there was discussion in Q&A as part of that. And at the conclusion, the Audit Finance Committee approved the report and also included in the motion that a game plan for implementation of recommendations be presented back to the Audit Finance Committee of the Chief of Board in May, as well as that there be some additional follow-up review by BLX in about a year. So I just wanted to give that background information. So the CHESLA report is being provided to the CHESLA board today for your acceptance, but I wanted to make you aware of what went on last week. And so with that, I will turn it over to Sandy Stallings, who is with BLX, and Richard Churl, who is also on the line. He's a partner with ORIC, which is the law firm that is the parent of BLX. And then also we have joining us today, Ray Bentley, with Amtech, who is CHESLA's provider of the calculation services. So, Sandy.
Great, thank you, Jeanette.
Great, thank you.
Just wanted to basically echo what Jeanette said in that we were hired this past summer through an RFP process and really hired because of our body of work related to student loan issuers throughout the country. As you know, student loan issuers are very rare, and the IRS doesn't really fully understand this industry, and therefore there's really not much specific guidance related to student loan debt or these types of financings and the arbitrage implications. But we work with dozens of student loan issuers across the country, and I've been working with Richard Churl specifically for over 22 years and working in with these types of calculations. And I know this topic is very technical, and some of you have already heard it last week, but I want to provide you with some kind of overview of the arbitrage provisions, how it impacts the actual CHESLA calculations, and so forth. But basically, we were asked to review the external arbitrage reporting prepared by Amtech for Chesla. And if you want to advance the screen, Deborah, to the scope of work, that would be helpful. First, we were asked to look at the rebate reports, which are the reports related to the non-purpose investments. So that's the looking at the excess arbitrage or the potential for arbitrage on your cash and investments that are not yet into loans. And then there's also a separate requirement for student loan issuers, and that you have to worry about the loan yield compliance, which we refer to throughout this conversation as API reports. So there is a provision that you have to monitor the yield on your loans over the life of your bond issue. And if there ends up being an excess, you might potentially have to either cut a check to the IRS or forgive loans. So there's two different sets of compliance requirements for Chesla, both the rebate side, the non-purpose, as well as the loans, the purpose side. So we reviewed both those types of reports, and then we were asked to prepare the findings, a write-up of the findings and the recommendations. And hopefully all of you have had a chance to read that report that was submitted a few weeks ago in draft form. Next slide, Deborah. So many of the student loan issuers that we work with across the country have positive liabilities, positive arbitrage liabilities, mainly related to the loans, just because of the nature of their financings and the rates that you're able to get on those student loans versus the tax exempt rate that you're paying on your bonds. That's what gives the ability to even earn positive arbitrage. We know right now on cash and investments are less than 1%. So that's not generating a lot of positive arbitrage in this industry, but it's the loan side that ends up having a lot more issues where issuers are having to work out how to manage these liabilities and how to stay in front of these liabilities. So of the 14 bond issues that we were provided a list of, we selected two rebate reports and four loan yield reports to review. And I've listed the bond issues there that we took a look at. So 10As was an API report, and it was showing a negative $600,000 cumulative arbitrage position through June 2020, and so on and so forth. So the 2012As, you can see that bond issue was positive. A rebate and yield restriction payment was made on the non-purpose investments when those bonds went final in April 2018. And then the API or the loan yield was just barely negative, negative $12,000. On the 13As, it's already showing a $300,000 positive liability through June of 2020. The 2016As showing negative $200,000 plus on both the rebate and the loan yield side. And we'll come back to this page in a few minutes, but I wanted to kind of give you an idea of what we found in the existing reports, and then we'll compare that with what we think the actual reliability would be if some of these other findings that we found were actually taken into consideration.
Sandy, if I can just embellish a little bit, the fact that the API reports, that is the yield on the student loans, is in some cases are significantly negative arbitrage, does not mean that those programs are not functioning well and are underwater, if you will. And that is because what the tax law provides is that the issuer, Chesla, is entitled to earn a yield on the student loans that is 2% above the tax-exempt bond borrowing cost. So you're allowed a spread. And so the negative amounts, for example, if you're looking at this chart, 2016A, that's negative 200 plus thousand, that simply means that it is negative 200,000 below the maximum that is allowed under the tax law, which is the bond yield plus 2%. So again, being negative does not necessarily mean that the program is not functioning well. It is just within the tax law limitation. On the other hand, if you look at the 2013A, which has 300,000 of positive, that means that that transaction is earning on the student loans more than the bond yield plus the allowable 2% spread. And that is something that Chesla needs to be aware of, because in order to comply with the tax law requirements over the term of the bond issue, that transaction has to be brought back into compliance so that the amount of positive arbitrage is zero or a negative. And there's a variety of ways to do that. So I just wanted to kind of embellish on what this chart shows you.
So right. I have a question. If there any payment is due the IRS, does it come out of the bond indenture or does it have to be paid separately?
Well, the source, so if you look at the 2012A, where there were two payments totaling $52,000, the tax law does not require that the money come from any particular source of funds. It may be the case that Chesla is setting aside arbitrage profits or investment profits into a arbitrage rebate fund, in which case that could be the source of payment of the rebate. That's not something we looked at, and I don't know if others who know the program better and know the indenture better than we do can identify where the money comes from. But the tax law does not impose any limitation on where the money comes from.
Jeanette, Marty, or Judith? Yeah.
Yeah, Marty, this is Judith. The indentures contemplate that the money will come from within the indenture, but the authority has agreed to the extent it's not available, other monies would be provided. But there should be, if you're earning that much above the loan yield or the bond yield, you should have revenues sufficient to pay the arbitrage payment.
Thanks.
Can I just make a comment as well? From an accounting perspective, the authority carries any liability on its balance sheet, so it's accounted for in their financial statements as a liability. So when they report net assets, though, that's not part of net assets.
Thank you.
And that's an important, this is Richard again, important point, because the reason to do periodic, and the best way to do it is to do annual arbitrage reports, is so that the authority is aware of what its potential liability might be and can put that on its books. And with respect to the rebate reports, that if it's positive, like the 2012A, that means that Chesla will have to write a check to the IRS. So it's good to accrue that liability. With respect to the student loan yields, referred to as the API reports, if you have a positive amount, like the $309,000 for the 213A, that's important to know, because it's not necessarily that Chesla is going to write a check to the IRS, but rather over the remaining term of that bond issue, Chesla wants to manage the student loans, the yield on those student loans, in a way so that gets back down to zero. So knowing where you stand on an annual basis and then planning to address any positive is an important, it is really the reason to do these reports.
Jeanette, one more question. Do we do this annually, or how often do we do our arbitrage calculations?
I would ask Ray Bentley of Amtec to speak to that, please.
Hi. Yes, they are typically completed annually for the arbitrage calculations. The annual bond year end has been 5/15 each year. So upon receiving the necessary bond and investment documentation, the reports are issued shortly thereafter. The API reports have a 6/1 bond year at this point, which I believe Sandy will, you know, get into later on. And so those have been delivered after 6/1 of each year.
It would seem to me this is a requirement. Otherwise, we don't have accurate financial statements. If we're supposed to accrue any liabilities and we don't know what they are, we got a problem. So I'm happy to hear we do it annually.
Okay. Continue.
Sandy, back to you.
Okay, great. Next slide, please, Deborah. So based upon our review of these six calculations, we found areas where we thought there should be some improved or increased regulatory guidance, as well as some additional technical analysis. And so we've provided a list here of the five different areas that we touch upon further in our conversation here today. But basically, the first one is the treatment of the qualified administrative expense offsets. The regulations allow you to take into account an offset against your loan yield, some qualified administrative expenses. And so, as Richard was mentioning, you get that 2% spread, but these amounts also help you to get within that 2% spread. And we could see that there would be, if this rule was applied differently, there'd be a material impact on the API liabilities for both the 2010, 2013, and 2016 A bond issues. We also found that there needed to be some research into the application of universal cap. There was definitely a material impact for the rebate report and the API report for the 2012 A bonds, which indicated either a substantial overpayment or potential underpayment. And we also found that there should be some improvement in the treatment of the semiannual gathering allowance, as well as the consistency of the bond yield between the different types of the reports, as well as the consistency of the bond year between the different types of reports. Next slide, please. So because of these materiality related to these findings and the impact on the dollar amount of liability, we have rated the level of risk for CHESLA to be in non-compliance as high. And we find that these findings may pose a significant risk for non-compliance, maybe possibly under-reporting or underpayment of arbitrage liabilities due to the misapplication of the regulatory provisions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Richard to go through some of the regulatory backdrop related to these five different findings. Deborah, next slide, and Richard.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk through some of the details and try and avoid being too technical, although this is a very, very technical area of the tax law. But I'm going to try and explain it as simple as possible. And then after explaining this, then Sandy will go through the details of how these rules apply in the CHESLA reports. So the first rule that I wanted to address, and Sandy mentioned this in the prior slide, is the treatment of administrative expense offsets. What this rule means is, again, if we go back to the concept that the tax law allows the yield on the loans to be 2% higher than the yield on the bonds, so that CHESLA can retain a 2% profit on those loans above the borrowing costs. In addition, and here's where this rule comes into play, the IRS recognizes that in a bond deal, CHESLA is going to incur certain costs of issuing those bonds and also carrying those bonds, like trustee fees and remarketing fees. And so the IRS allows the loans to earn 2% above the bond yield plus an amount to reimburse CHESLA for its costs relating to the bonds. And that's what this rule does, is it says, CHESLA, you can earn bond yield plus 2% plus an additional return on the loans to recover the costs of the bond issue. And the tax law requires that in computing how you can recover those costs of issuance, you must amortize those costs of the bonds over the term of the bond issue. So if you have a 15-year bond issue, you take your costs, you amortize it over the 15 years, and you're allowed to recover the cost of the bond issue over that 15-year period. Next slide, please. The next rule is called the universal cap. And in simplistic terms, what this means is that the tax law, the IRS and the tax law recognizes that in imposing arbitrage limitations, the arbitrage limitations should not be imposed on assets of CHESLA in an amount greater than the amount of the bond issue. And most student loan transactions are set up so that the bond issue will have a positive amount of assets, that is positive parity. You will have more assets associated with the bond issue than the amount of bonds. So just to walk through that quickly, if you issued a $50 million tax-exempt bond issue, initially you would have $50 million of bond proceeds, because that's what you borrowed, and it would be invested on a temporary basis until you made loans. And those temporary investments are known as the non-purpose investments. That's IRS lingo for the fact that those temporary investments are not why you issued the bonds. The reason you issued the bonds is to make loans. So we have non-purpose investments, which are your temporary investments, and the loans the IRS refers to as purpose investments. So at the outset, you have $50 million of bonds, you have $50 million of proceeds invested on a temporary basis, and then you use that money to make loans. And as you make loans, those loans are going to generate a positive cash flow, and that positive cash flow can be used to pay down bonds, but also because you have excess, you can either pay down more bonds than you have loans, or you can recycle the loan payments to make more loans. So as a result, over time, your bond issue, which starts out as 50 of debt and 50 of proceeds, so you're at parity, over time, your bond issue will pay down and your assets will either stay higher or even go up. So you wind up with more assets than you have bonds. That is excess parity, and that's a good thing. That's a healthy program. And the IRS says, well, for arbitrage purposes, you only have to apply the arbitrage rules to an amount of assets equal to the amount of bonds outstanding. So if you pay down bonds and now you only have $40 million of bonds outstanding, but you have $45 million of assets, then $40 million of the assets are subject to arbitrage restrictions and $5 million is outside, and the rule's called the universal cap. It's a cap on the amount of assets taken into account. And so it's important in computing your arbitrage compliance to recognize that a healthy student loan program is going to have excess assets that do not have to be taken into account for arbitrage purposes. And that can reduce your arbitrage liability. Next slide, please. Another technical rule is that the IRS recognizes that the payments of the loans will come in daily, weekly, you know, very, very often. But the payout on the bonds is typically semi-annual, although if you have variable rate bonds, the payout may be more often than semi-annual. And the IRS recognizes that keeping track of your loan receipts as they come in, maybe every single day, will be a very significant administrative burden. So the IRS has a rule that allows the loan receipts to be gathered and accumulated and only taken into account on a semi-annual basis if your bonds are paying debt service on a semi-annual basis. So this is a rule of administrative relief. And it also has an impact on your loan yield, because if on a present value basis, if you receive money today, tomorrow, the next day, all those loan payments are coming in on a daily basis. You've got those loan payments coming in very quickly. But the tax law says, oh, you can defer when you're taking those loans and loan payments into account until the next 6 month payment date. So you can push the payment out for yield purposes, and that will have the effect of treating your loans as having a lower yield, gives you more room within the 2% allowance. So this is another important rule. And it's a rule of a relief for CHESLA and other student loan issuers. Next slide, please. And here I'm touching on two rules that do not have a significant impact on the loan yield, but is a matter of really having as accurate as possible information and reports. And that is that the bond yield is the baseline for all arbitrage calculations. Remember, if your non-purpose investments earn above the bond yield, you have to make a payment to the IRS. That's positive arbitrage earned. If your student loans have a yield that is more than 2% above the bond yield, then you have excess arbitrage. So the bond yield is your baseline and a very important element. We found in looking at some of the reports, there was some inconsistency where there would be a bond yield used for the rebate report, and for the same bond issue, the bond yield would be slightly different for the APIs. So there should be consistency, and that's just a not going to be a significant impact because the yields were very close, but something that would improve the accuracy of the reports. And a similar point is that in doing your annual reports, the tax law says the CHESLA must select a bond year, and that would be the date on which the annual report is calculated. And that bond year should be consistent for the rebate reports and for the API reports. And we found, and actually it was mentioned earlier, that the rebate reports are done, I believe, on May 15th, and the API reports are done as of June 1. And so an improvement in the accuracy of the reports would be to have those be consistent. So next page, and back to Sandy. I think I've covered the these items. I may have also covered some of the points you were going to make, but please go ahead.
No, that's great. Thank you, Richard. So our recommendation related to these qualified administrative costs is to do a proration of the cost of issuance within the calculations. Currently, the calculations are treated as all expenses are treated as the present value on delivery. And so, for instance, if you pay a $600,000 underwriter discount at closing, or that's netted from your bond proceeds, the calculations currently show that as one lump sum at closing, and then you have the compounding impact, and it's a very significant impact to the liability. But if it's a 10 or 20 year bond issue, you should only be showing either, you know, the 1/10th or 1/20th of that amount in any given bond year. So for instance, if you were to go and prorate the cost of issuance over time, Deborah, do you mind going back to slide 3 real quick on the chart? There you go. Thank you. So on the 2010A, if you actually were to prorate the cost of issuance the way that I've described, that liability that is showing $600,000 negative would actually be a positive $50,000 liability on your books currently. With respect to the 2013As, the positive $300,000 liability that's currently reflected would actually be a $600,000 liability currently that should be reflected on your books. And on the 16As, we're currently showing negative $240,000 on the loan yield calculation. But if you took these cost of issuance into account over the life of the bond issue, that liability would actually be a positive $45,000 liability. So you can see there is a material swing in the liabilities given the prorated cost of issuance as opposed to treating them as a lump sum as they currently are being presented.
Now, just to add on that, as Sandy's pointing out, this treatment of the administrative costs has amortized over the term of the issue. By contrast, the way the reports are done, where the costs are taken into account up front, it has a very significant impact on the rebate liability. However, over the term of the bond issue, that is, as the deal progresses, towards its maturity, this impact will, the differential between these two ways of accounting will amortize, and the impact will be lessened over the term of the issue. But the reason we're talking about changing the methodology of taking into account the qualified administrative cost is that we're making a recommendation of what is technically required under the tax law. And the idea is to give you a more accurate snapshot of what is the arbitrage status as of each annual report. So there's two different things for CESLA to think about in connection with its rebate status. One is, what's the rebate status as a snapshot as of the point you're preparing your financial statements? And so that's one picture. What is the rebate liability as of today? And the second is planning to deal with any positive over the term of the issue. So one is, what's the snapshot? Two is, what's the planning to eliminate any positive? And our analysis, our audit, is focusing on what's your snapshot, what's your annual report.
I have two questions. One is the amortization process, one that is required by law, and that the discounting that we use not permissible under law.
So the requirement that it be amortized over the term of the issue is what the tax regulations require.
Right. The next question I have is, my understanding of generally accepted accounting principles that are applicable is in financial statements where you have taken an aggressive position with respect to your tax liabilities, you are supposed to disclose that. I don't know if our controller or we have accounting people on the phone who deal with that issue under generally accepted accounting principles. Because if we are taking a more aggressive approach with respect to our arbitrage obligations, then maybe that is something that has to be disclosed.
Mm-hmm. So, Marty, what I would say is our plan with regard to how we are responding to these recommendations is that we are going to sit with, meet with our bond counsel, Dave Pitney, our financial advisor, Hilltop, as well as Amtech. We're going to go through these recommendations and review the regs in the context of what have we been doing historically, what is the historical interpretation of the regs, what is the recommendation, and we will be, the plan is to implement the recommendations going forward as appropriate. But historically, there has not been any indication from any of our service providers or counsel that we are aggressively taking an approach that requires disclosure in the financial statement. So all of this will be reviewed as part of our going forward plan that we're putting together for April, and we are certainly taking the recommendations seriously and looking at it in the context of what has been our past interpretation, what should be the interpretation going forward. Has there been a view that it's a gray area, and as opposed to something that's totally black and white? And so that's part of our process going forward.
Well, Jeanette, I would ask you to include, maybe not at the beginning, but at some time in that group's consideration of these issues, a representative or independent accountants. I think it's very important. The last thing we want to do is hide something from our independent accountants. And I think they are entitled to understand what we're doing and how we intend to go forward. So I ask to add to your group at some appropriate time a representative of our independent accountants.
Yes, we will certainly confer with Cohn Resnick, our independent auditors, and yeah, clearly there's no intention of hiding things from the auditors.
Thank you.
And one other point, if I may, as a transition back to Sandy moving on to other points, and to address your point, Mr. Budd, which is a very good one of, you know, how is this being recorded for accounting purposes, is that some of the other recommendations that BLX is making, and I'm going to focus on the universal cap, which Sandy's going to talk about next, may have the impact of reducing the positive rebate, a positive liability. So there's some recommendations we're making, like this administrative cost treatment, that has the effect of increasing the positive liability, but the universal cap, and we didn't rerun the numbers, that wasn't in the scope of what we were doing, may have the impact of lowering the amount of positive liability. So you have some ups and some downs, and you know, all of our recommendations, when taken into account, may not have that much of a big swing.
Thank you.
I actually have a quick question before you move on. Do we have any sense why the tax law would require the handling of those admin costs pro rata when in reality those costs are indeed at the closing of the issuance?
Well, I think the tax regulation is following generally accepted accounting and general tax rules, which are that costs of issuing a bond issue for accounting purposes and for regular tax purposes are treated as an amortizable expense over the term of the issue. So that's just normal accounting. And I think the rebate, the arbitrage rules, are simply reflecting the normal tax accounting. And basically saying, in effect, okay, you paid out, you know, on a $50 million deal, maybe you paid out $1 million of costs of issuing the bonds, and the allowance for administrative costs is to allow the student loans to earn above the bond yield, 2% above the bond yield, plus some more to reimburse for those costs of issuance. So the whole concept is to earn it back over time.
Understood. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, Deborah, do you mind going back to slide 11 for me? So the other recommendation that we had was related to the universal cap, and we've talked about it quite a bit, so I'll just quickly cover some of the points. But definitely the universal cap should be tested annually, and at least it's the same test for both rebate and API reports. It's tested as of each bond year and should be applied on a formal basis if there are amounts or assets to be deallocated. So most of all of your deals should be at or above parity. So it would not be uncommon that you'd have amounts being deallocated. And it should be performed whether there's an overall liability or negative or positive. It's not really, the liability itself is not relevant to whether or not you need to test. You could be adding too much positive arbitrage to your deal, so you'd want to deallocate assets, or conversely, you might be accounting for too much negative arbitrage because you're associating some of that negative arbitrage to these assets that should be deallocated. So really, you should be looking at the test whether or not there's a liability on the bond issue. And to be able to do this test correctly, you have to be able to classify all your assets. And the regs require that the assets be categorized as either replacement proceeds, transferred proceeds, or sales and investment proceeds. So there's different ordering rules based upon the nexus with your bond issue as to which amounts get deallocated first. So you have to go through that whole process, and it's not easy, it's very technical, but it should be performed so that this test can be applied accurately. Basically, as we've already said, the cap is the total value of your bonds. Hopefully your bonds are playing par. It's simple as par plus accrued interest. If it's not, bonds are non-playing par. You'd have to present value those bonds and so forth. But you compare your total bonds to your total assets. It's your cash, your temporary investments, and your loans for a given bond issue. And then if there's an excess, you start to look at where, what am I going to deallocate in the rebate report, or what might I deallocate in the loan yield report? And it really depends, again, on the classification of your assets. So again, it's not a simple test. There's a lot of work to be done, and it's not something you can just eyeball. You really need to pencil all this out to figure out whether or not your universal cap is exceeded, and if so, what gets deallocated, and it's consistent amongst the different reports for that various bond issue. Next slide,
Sandy, please. Sandy, do you want to maybe flip back to slide 3 and just take a look at, again, until you run the numbers, you don't know for sure. Thank you, Deborah. But for example, if you look at the 2012A, which did result in a payment to the IRS of $52,000 of positive arbitrage earnings, you got to actually apply the universal cap and see what it comes out to be. But if that deal was positive parity, which based on what we saw, we think it probably was, that means that some of the investments could be deallocated. That means to the extent you have assets above the amount of bonds in any year, then some of those assets can be moved away and are not subject to arbitrage restrictions. So that could mean that instead of paying $52,000 to the IRS, maybe the rebate liability is a lower figure. And similarly, if we look at 2013A, which the student loans are producing $309,000 of positive, that's the amount of excess earnings above the 2% allowance that whole pot of student loans are earning. But if that deal is positive parity, which it probably is, then some of those loans can be moved to the side for purposes of the arbitrage report. And then you compute the excess yield on a smaller pot so that it is possible that the $309,000 figure gets smaller by applying the universal cap. The flip side is deals that are negative arbitrage, well, maybe some of those loans are producing negative amounts and you should only be taking into account a smaller amount of loans so the negative gets less negative. So we think universal cap will have a potentially significant impact on the numbers here.
We went through this exercise like that prior to when Chesla became a subsidiary of CHIFA under the old version of the board. I think Amtech can remember us going through that process because they helped us with that in the prior version of this board. So,
Jeanette, I take it once you go through all of these recalculations, you'll report to the board in a simple way showing what we had reported or paid to the IRS and what we think actually was the correct calculations, so that we can then decide, God forbid, that we should apply for a refund or whether we think we are in a position where we may owe more than we think and have to record a greater liability on our balance sheet. But I take it that for April or May.
Yes, as I mentioned, the plan is we will work through these recommendations with bond counsel, Amtech, and our financial advisor. I think it's premature for me to comment at this point as to whether or not there will be a recalculation which will result in a particular number or change. Whatever the outcome of our review is, we will, and the game plan for moving forward, yes, that will be presented. It will be going to the Chief Audit Finance Committee in April, and then we will also report it to the CHESLA board. So that's the plan going forward.
But am I not correct that this is truly an obligation of the CHESLA board? When a rebate payment is made, it is on the CHESLA name and letterhead, not the CHIFA letterhead.
Yeah.
Correct. And so given that, we will definitely be presenting it to the CHESLA board, and maybe one approach we can take is to use the March board meeting, which is the next CHESLA board meeting. Between now and then, we can go through and take a closer look at some of our historical calculations and give a sense of where things are in March, so that the CHESLA board will have, you know, timely information and a clear sense of what we think any actual changes will be if the conclusion is that there need to be any recalculations.
But the CHIFA board, although it is our parent and controlling holder, ought to be aware that these decisions are decisions that the CHESLA board has to make.
Well, I think the CHIFA board is aware that they don't control the budget or the, you know, revenues and expenses, so to speak, of CHESLA. So, yes, the CHIFA board knows that whatever, you know, whatever dollars are involved are a CHESLA responsibility, not a CHIFA responsibility. Yes.
And reporting on our financial statements as well.
Right.
Well, the financial statements are comprehensive and include both CHIFA and CHESLA.
Right. So they do have an obligation in that regard.
Correct.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure. Deborah, back to slide 12, please. So our next recommendation has a little bit less of a minor, less of an impact on the calculations, but it's just basically trying to line up calculations to be more accurate through the semi-annual gathering dates of May 15th and November 15th. Currently, the reports are being prepared with the gathering on June 1 and December 1st. And so we just think it should line up with the debt service payment dates. I know the other dates were used out of ease and some simplicity and the availability of records. But management has already reached out to the loan servicer, and they're able to provide data through either the month as well as split out the prepayments from the non-regular monthly receipts. So all that should be good, and they should be able to pull that into the next set of calculations.
I would just like to add some clarity there. My understanding is some of these reporting aspects were a restriction of the prior servicer, so that can be achievable. It will be more work on everybody's end, including Carly and myself, but we'll take care of it.
Okay, good. As Richard already mentioned on the bond yield calculation, the next slide, please, Deborah. We saw some inconsistencies in the bond yield between the different types of reporting. You know, we understand the nuance of continuous compounding helping on the API front, but we felt that there should be a consistent bond yield between the rebate report and the API report for the different bond issues, as well as defining and using a consistent bond year between the reporting. Again, your universal cap test is provided and prepared as of each bond year. And so if you're using a May 15th bond year for rebate, but a June 1 bond year for API purposes, it just doesn't sync up. So there's one definition per bond issue, and, you know, pick a date which works for you. If it's May 15th, great, or June 1st, great, but let's use a consistent date between the two different types of reporting. And then the next slide, Deborah. We would recommend that you move forward with an annual frequency on the API reporting. We could see where the rebate reports are being prepared annually. However, when the summary was provided for us, it didn't appear that the API summary had been updated with annual liabilities. So just make sure both are done in sync and at the same time would help with consistency amongst those reports. We also thought you might want to look at improving transparency in the API reports so that the CHESLA staff can easily confirm, you know, what's included in the cash flows, what items are being gathered, what are my offsetting expense items, can my totals tie back to the source documents that I provided to Amtech, is my universal cap being applied, is it being taken into account, what's the universal cap status. These things just help add transparency to know what's exactly in those reports, whereas right now everything is just presented in one lump sum cash flow, and it's difficult for the reader to determine like what is going into these calculations and what's being taken into account. Next slide, Deborah. Based upon all of these findings, we felt that the external reporting needed improvement. There were some significant weaknesses that we think can be improved. We want to make sure that your risks are being managed and your objectives are being met. And I think everyone's on board to look into this immediately. And I think you had mentioned on talking about it again at the March meeting. So I think management is on board with reviewing these items and taking a look at that.
I'll just note that what we've presented here in this slide presentation is designed, hopefully, it's a technical subject, but, you know, we try to explain it and to simplify it. BLX has prepared and submitted a more detailed memorandum that goes through each of the bond issues in a more technical manner. And that report also includes management's response to the BLX report, as well as Amtech's response to the comments that BLX made. So it's a much more robust document if you're interested in taking a look at it.
And I would just mention that document was included in everyone's board package.
All right. Jeanette, this is an action item for the board, correct? We need to accept the report.
So yes, the plan is for the board to vote to accept the report. Right. Yes.
Okay. So why don't we get a motion out there and see if there's any further discussion. Is there a motion by board member to accept the report as presented by BLX?
So moved.
Second. Is there a second?
Second.
Great. We got a motion and a second. Are there any further questions or comments, for Chesla staff or for Sandy or Richard with regard to the presentation and findings?
I thought it was a very good presentation, explaining for the layperson what all these complicated rules were about. And I thought BLX is to be complimented on this oral presentation.
I would agree, Marty. It's a very technical area. It's the second time I've sat through this presentation, and I still won't profess to understanding all the technicalities, but I do appreciate Richard and Sandy breaking it down to lay people like myself. So thank you.
Well, this was Arbitrage 101, and you guys all get a graduate, a degree in that, and we could move you up. We could step you guys up if you're interested.
Yeah, if this was ARB 101, forgive me if I don't sign up for ARB 202. Okay.
Sandy and I really want to extend our thanks to have the opportunity to work with Chesla, meet all of you on the board, and to work with the staff. It's been an interesting and important project, and we enjoyed the opportunity. So thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you for your feedback and recommendations, and we look forward to working through them.
Great. And if it's okay, I think we'll drop from the rest of your meeting, is that right?
We won't be offended.
Okay. All right, thank you all very much.
Let's finish up this bit of the business, though, and vote on the motion. We have a motion and a second to accept the report. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Is there anyone opposed? Are there any abstentions? Thank you. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you again, Richard and Sandy.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Stay safe and healthy. Be well.
Thank you. You also.
Care. Bye-bye.
Okay, 12:30. Jeanette, I guess over to you for an executive director's report. I think we're going to start with the legislative update. You and Dan.
Can I ask a question now that our friends from BMX How much did that report cost us?
Jeanette
looks frozen. However, Chifa is the lead on the internal audit engagement. So Chifa did pay for that engagement.
Thank you.
Do we know how much it cost Chifa?
Yes, it was approximately the Chifa piece of it, I believe, was about $9,000 or so.
How much? Nine?
About $9,000 or so, yeah. But I do have, I can get the actual invoice.
No, but that I think that was a good buy.
Okay.
Hello. I think I lost my connection. I apologize.
Okay. I think we can hear you now, Jeanette. So we're up to the legislative update for you and Dan.
Okay. Yeah, so I wanted to mention that we are moving forward with our legislative agenda, and we have met with many legislative representatives highlighting the minority teacher recruitment proposal, and it's been well received. And we've also done quite a bit of collaboration with the State Department of Education, working specifically with their chief talent officer. And I'd like to ask Dan Junji, who's the communications and government relations specialist for Chifa, to provide a further update.
Thanks, Jeanette. Just to kind of highlight a few of the key meetings that we've had, we have met with the co-chairs of the Higher Education Committee and presented our minority teacher recruitment program proposal to them. We did receive favorable feedback from both co-chairs and an indication that they are sending it to the legislative commissioner's office to be drafted into a bill. We're in the process of also scheduling meetings with the ranking members of the Higher Education Committee. The next big step in the process will be getting the bill scheduled for a public hearing. And in addition to meeting with the higher ed co-chairs, I think two more noteworthy meetings that I just wanted to touch on. We've met with Speaker Matt Ritter, and we've also met with Majority Leader Jason Rojas and received favorable feedback from them as well. In terms of upcoming meetings, we are working to schedule a meeting with Senator Martin Looney, and we do have a meeting tomorrow with Senator Bob Duff's lead attorney. Thanks, Jeanette.
So that's all I have with regard to the legislative update. Are there any questions? Okay. The next segment of the executive director's report is the cash flow review, as included in your board package. And that'll be a presentation by Tim Webb of Hilltop Securities.
Good afternoon, or I guess it's afternoon up in Connecticut. Thanks for that introduction, Jeanette. What we've done here is we're responding to a question that Mr. Budd put forth, I believe, in the last board meeting with regard to the utilization of bond proceeds from the 19A taxable transaction closed in May, June of 2019. The originations have been slower than anticipated, and as of that board meeting, there are approximately $1.5 million of proceeds. These are taxable bonds that were unexpended. So what we did was to, Mr. Budd asked us whether or not this presented any issues with regard to the ability of the authority to make debt service payments on those bonds or any of the bonds associated within that trust. So we agreed that there would be some cash flows run. Cash flows were run by Bank of America. They have the cash flows from the closing of the 2020 transaction, the most up-to-date cash flows that were run on the trust. And we made some adjustments with regard to the anticipated utilization of those funds. So the first slide that you have up there on your screens indicate the difference between the assumptions utilized in the closing cash flows of the 2020 transaction and what were just performed. On the left side of the screen, you'll see that the closing cash flows projected that the $1 million would be utilized from July of 2020 through February of 2020. In these new cash flows, we've pushed that out a year. So in other words, you would have until 1/15 or 2/15 of 22 before all the proceeds were being utilized. Also updated the actual originations that have occurred relative to the 20B transaction. When the 20 issue was closed, you had new money proceeds associated with 20B, which would be used for Chesla's in-school program. Those are now being originated. So the information on the right side of the screen relative to 20B reflect actual originations have occurred and some projections that we received from Josh. So this is the new assumption relative to these cash flows. One thing I would like to indicate here is that, you know, we will be running new cash flows in the spring based on new information when we do a new transaction to provide funding for the 21-22 academic year. So these will be run again in roughly 6 months. If we could go to the next slide, unless there are any questions about this slide.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand this. The 2019B actually got used more quickly than the cash flow projections. Is that correct? Do I understand that to be correct?
That's correct.
Two, my understanding is you can't use 2019B money to pay off 2019A interest and principal because one's taxable and one's tax exempt, but that you might be able to use the equity that was allocated to 2019B or even 2020B to pay some of the 2019A if that ever became required.
So, Mark, I would let the bond counsel respond to that.
And if I could just jump in here, Marty, and mention that if you recall, after the September board meeting, the question came up about the dollars available in the 2019A revenue account and whether or not they'd be sufficient to pay debt service on the 2019As. And we did an analysis, which we sent out to all board members, projecting out through November 2021. Showing that yes, there's ample money in the 2019A revenue account for it to pay the debt service on its own series. So there's no anticipation of having to slide money between series. But yes, if Judith wants to speak to, you know, the potential tax complications of taking revenue from Series B and applying it to Series A.
Jeanette, but I had a question first. When you say revenues in the 2019A, are you including proceeds that have not been used?
No, the revenue account is revenue from loan repayment.
That's what I thought, but you haven't originated very much in the 2019As. I'm surprised that there's enough revenue from just those $400,000 or $500,000 out of $1.5 million to cover the
food. Marty, this is
go ahead, Josh.
If I could just chime in here. So Marty, if you recall, when we completed the 2019 deal, we contributed loans from our pilot program to both the tax exempt and taxable portion.
So there are additional loans in the 2019A that came from another series.
they did not come from another series. They were loans that were held on the balance sheet by Cheslow.
Well, how would they
The pilot program came from cash.
Oh, that's right. We had contributed. I think we had several million dollars. Right.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
That's correct. And the $1.5 million is the remainder of the $5 million that was there available. So the authority has originated the difference between $5 million and $1.5 million, or $3.5 million, plus the contributed loans there with regard to the 19As.
Right. The $3.5 million was using Chess's own money. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. The authority in 2019 issued $5 million worth of taxable bonds. There are $5 million worth of proceeds that were available for the origination of refi loans. Approximately 3.5 have been utilized to this point. There's a remaining amount of 1.5.
Was that taxable loans?
Those were taxable bonds.
Yeah.
Yes, taxable bonds.
And you said why? Was that the 219A, $5 million?
Yes.
But why do you say that there were $3.5 million of loans? It doesn't show that on the on this chart.
Because they had been originated prior to this cash flow being completed.
I see.
This cash flow is starting in effectively April of 2020. By the point we got to April of 2020, $3.5 million of the $5 million had been utilized.
I see. So
the 1.5 reflects the remaining amount of proceeds that need to be utilized.
Thank you very much. Yes. So this is just an updated cash flow, as you previously said.
Correct.
Thank you.
You bet. So the next page just shows the differential between the parity of the transaction by having the loans originated per the issuance cash flows versus the updated origination schedule that reflects a year longer in taking the ability of getting the loans out the door. So if we delay the originations by a year versus the issuance cash flows, this is the difference in parity. And it shows a very little decrease, not a significant decrease in the parity or the coverage of assets over liabilities as a result of the delay in the origination. The next page, page 19, shows the updated original cash flows. And what I want to show here is just that there are no draws on the reserve fund. If you look in the column fourth from the right, it says RES TAPS distributions. The first one of $1.7 million is actually a deposit to the reserve fund when we issued the bond in this summer. But you'll notice that underneath that $1,857,000, there are no TAPS. There's no money going out of that fund to make any kind of debt service payments. So what this cash flow indicates is that with the delayed origination schedule for the 2019A remaining proceeds, the $1.5 million, if it's delayed a year, we do not have a tap on the reserve fund in order to make any debt service payments. Again, I want to emphasize that we'll be rerunning these cash flows here in another few months. When we get into the season of preparing for 2021-22 academic year in-school loan product, and we'll have an opportunity to update the assumptions relative to the utilization of those funds, or if there is no utilization of funds, we can make some decisions on how we would run that. But at this point, delaying the origination does not appear to be impacting the ability to pay those bonds based on the assumptions used in the cash flow.
Thank you, Tim. But, you know, from the reserve fund, it does show on page 20 the use of $2 million to pay off bonds, right?
No. What that is the bonds in this cash flow mature all as of 5/15/35, and that money is money that's remaining in the reserve fund at the point that the bonds are repaid. So that money is being released at that time.
Right. Thank you.
Now, part of Jeanette, I don't know if you plan to address this, but you know, the concept here is to make some adjustments to the refi program to help the loans go out the door a little bit more efficiently. And Josh and Jeanette have worked to adjust some of the terms associated with those refi loans that they believe will enable them to get them out the door.
Right. So, Josh, do you just want to touch on the updated pricing on the refi side that we're doing?
Yeah. So previously, the refi rates range from 4.75 to 6.9% fixed. And now we brought down the high end from 6.9 to 5.99. So the rates now range from 4.75 to 5.99% fixed. And enabling lower interest rates across the board for applicants.
And just you know, as Josh has touched on at prior meetings, our refinance volume has been affected by federal changes in connection in response to COVID. So to the extent that the feds have provided relief under the federal direct loan program, that has reduced interest in doing a refinancing of federal loans. And refinancing of federal loans had been a significant part of our volume. So we're also refocusing on trying to build awareness of the fact that you know we also refinance other types of private loans. So that's something we're trying to get out on social media and do greater outreach around that as well. So those are some of the things that we're doing to try to, you know, increase the origination flow on the refi side.
One of the president's executive orders yesterday extended the direct loan payment moratorium all the way to September 30th, the end of the federal fiscal
yeah.
year.
Right. So that, you know, that's why we're focused on, you know, making sure people are aware that other private loans can be refinanced through CHESLA.
I would just like to add to that. So going off of what Steve mentioned, I've already updated the CHESLA website, and I reached out to Campus Door to update the disclosures on the refinance application and also the disclosures on the in-school side as well.
So, unless there are any other questions for Tim, I just had one other update as part of the executive director's report. That is pursuant to CHESLA's official procedures. Anytime we exceed budget for any purpose, even if it's below the $5,000 threshold, which requires board approval, we have to bring it to the board's attention. So we had our financial literacy provider on our CT Dollars and Cents platform, which had been offering us content at no charge. They informed us, you know, a few months ago that was going to change and they would be implementing a charge. The charge is being implemented as of January 1st of 21, and so there'll be $2,000 in excess of budget with regard to that content. And as I mentioned, the procedures require board approval for any expenses of $5,000 or greater that are in excess of budget, but just board notification if there are things under $5,000. So I'm just notifying the board of that. And actually, the last thing I'll just mention is our advisory board member, one of our members, Dave Welsh, has chosen to come off of the advisory board. And so we will be pursuing identifying some additional advisory board members. So that's it for the executive director's report.
And I just want to say, going off of that, I've known Dave Walsh for years, and just want the record to show that we've appreciated his expertise on the advisory board.
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
Any questions for Jeanette? Okay, let's move right into the scholarship memo, an action item for the board. It's included in the memo's included in your board packet. Josh, do you want to just give us the highlights of this and entertain some questions?
So we'll start on page 23, and I think Natalia will kick us off.
Hi, everyone. So the second year of this year's scholarship went really well. We made two main adjustments from the first year. One of those being our contract with Fondant. They did a secure online portal for our applications this year instead of requiring mailed responses like we did for the first year. And this also benefited us in our scholarship committee evaluation process. And then the second one that we adjusted from the first year was that we separated the certificate program from the undergraduate scholarship, and it became a first come first serve open application. And we really think these adjustments helped us as a whole for applicants, third party recommenders, and the scholarship committee in evaluation. And we did see the number of qualified applications increase from 270 to 318 this year. So that's a big increase. And we will continue to use these two adjustments for the upcoming year that will be in March. Josh, if you want to continue.
And I'd also like to note that, because we weren't able to have a live scholarship ceremony this year, Shannon put together a great video recognizing all the recipients, and that was posted on our social media pages. In terms of the application period for this round of funding, basically the undergraduate scholarship will stay the same. It will open on March 1st and close on May 1st, and we plan to notify the recipients in July. Regarding the certificate program scholarship, and I think I need to reword or better explain this paragraph here. All we're basically saying is that should we run out of certificate funds before July 1st, July 1st would be when we would reopen the application. In reality, we're going to have significant funds remaining on the certificate side. So the application will just remain open all the way through. Are there any questions regarding that?
Josh, how many certificate program applications did we get?
Okay, so in the first year, we awarded one scholarship for $1,500. And this year so far, we've awarded six for $7,500, and there are three additional applications awaiting a letter of recommendation.
Okay, thank you.
Steve, this is Peter. Were you expecting more or less?
I was just wasn't sure there, and that is out of my curiosity associated with something else I'm doing offline. About certificate programs.
Okay. Well, I asked the question only because in a conversation I had with Jeanette earlier about the agenda, I asked basically the same question, and I thought that it would be much more than six. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if that's where you were going with your question.
But, yeah, I thought it might be more popular.
Yeah.
You know, it would be useful to know if we have any idea of how many people are in certificate programs in our community colleges, just to know what our bases that we're trying to reach out to.
Right, and I can say we're doing, Josh has been doing ongoing outreach to all of the community colleges and the Sacred Heart and others that have certificate programs to try to make sure there is awareness of these scholarship dollars. And we're also constantly taking a look at, you know, is there any issue with the completion of the FAFSA as a requirement? Is that a barrier to people applying for this scholarship? Because this is, you know, these are students who may not, you know, normally be applying, you know, filling out a FAFSA. So we're looking at all of those things as ways, you know, how can we expand awareness? If there are barriers, how can we reduce the barriers? All of those things are being looked at.
Yeah, I think there could be an issue where people don't fill out a FAFSA because they don't think a certificate's an eligible
right
purpose for any kind of financing. But I know in the community college programs are pretty much all eligible for the federal programs for financing too. So. And right, yeah. Ben?
Right.
It's a mixed bag. That's not entirely true.
Some.
We have
some credit, not all,
programs and some non-credit programs.
Yeah.
Non-credit
programs. Some are and some aren't. Right.
Well, I would just say, so we had touch base with Julie and Dave Welsh last year, and our understanding was that even the non-credit certificate programs that would not qualify for federal aid, that, you know, it's still probably our best methodology to determine need by asking them to fill out a FAFSA. I did some cursory research these past few weeks on developing another methodology to determine need besides the FAFSA. And it's very complicated. I'm not sure you would want to get rid of the FAFSA entirely if you were going to offer another option to determine need. Just recall that the FAFSA uses the prior year, so you could run into instances of, you know, what tax returns are you asking for, etc. So there's a lot of different options to consider. I would also say I reached out to the financial aid directors at Norwalk Community College and Naugatuck Community College, and they both we're like, you need to stick with the FAFSA. You'd be doing yourself a disservice by not doing that. With that said, we'll continue to examine options because it may be a barrier, but we'll continue to do the research.
You know, first of all, the FAFSA is being simplified. The law that passed in late December includes a complete revamping, and God help us, simplify it and make it easier, because it's a very complicated and difficult process now for students to do. So we're hopeful that the FAFSA process will improve going forward. I think the new FAFSA cycle starts for next fall even. So we're, it's a dynamic environment right now as to in the financial aid world. So it may be difficult to get a straight answer out of any of them because they don't really know how this new rule is going to work for them.
And this is Daryl. Having done the FAFSA for the past 2 years, it has gotten a little bit easier. It still is a bit of a bear, but it's a little bit more user-friendly this year than it was last year, as my kids are off in college, or one is, and one's getting ready to be.
Yeah, okay, know, Josh?
The only, you know, I'd just like to add just one more thing. This is Julie. I think, you know, when we first heard of this, there was a big push on the community college side and working with the workplace, with the different regions of the workforce placement. And I think that's what we were looking for with these certificates. It may be too that we have to look at the EFC level for students and looking at maybe expanding that a little bit, because some of these students that are going back are looking to retrain, and it's a different emphasis, I think, on the certificate programs versus regular need-based aid going into that. So that would be my only thought on that, which may actually discourage some students in certificate programs to even complete the FAFSA, because they feel that they won't demonstrate financial need, or that their estimated family contribution may be too high. But I don't know if that's maybe not helping, you know, helping our cause in getting more and more of these certificate, these students educated in these certificate programs that can help us across the state. So that might be another way to look at it as well.
Right. Yeah, Julie, I think that's a good point that, you know, maybe we should just step back and revisit with regard to the certificate program, you know, the workforce goals in general for the state. And maybe we don't need to, given the, you know, the relatively small portion that's going to certificates, maybe we don't need to put as much emphasis on the need-based, you know, aspect in terms of proving a certain level of need. So I think that's something we can also give consideration to.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's great feedback. So just continuing on, as Jeanette mentioned, we've marketed the certificate scholarships through many different channels, financial aid directors, the directors of the certificate programs at the institutions, state workforce boards, social media, and quarterly Cheslin newsletters. I did reach out to all financial aid directors, I believe it was last week, and I received some good feedback, and those directors said they were going to disseminate the information and also make it clear to their non-credit certificate programs and those students that they are there to help them fill out a FAFSA, because that's just one of the items that needs to be completed for the scholarship. And, overall, I mean, for the certificate scholarship, it's pretty simple. You have the application, you need to fill out the FAFSA and then provide a letter of recommendation. And then as long as we have funds remaining, you know, they get the scholarship. So moving forward, we are just looking for another $500,000 allocation. In the prior year, we had allocated $450,000 for undergraduate degree programs and $50,000 for certificate programs. We're looking to earmark a reduced amount for certificate programs this year, looking for a $470,000 allocation for undergraduate programs and $30,000 for certificate programs. And I would just also like to note that any unused certificate program funds will continue to remain in the scholarship account to be utilized in future years. And then in terms of the individual awards, it's basically the same as last year. $1,500 for a half-time student, $3,000 for a full-time student, and $1,250 for a certificate program student. And at a $30,000 certificate program allocation, that would result in 24 recipients. Are there any questions?
I'll move acceptance of that proposal.
Any second?
Second.
All right, we got a motion and a second. Josh, Natalia, thank you for that review. Are there any further questions, comments on the proposed, on the motion for the allocation? Questions? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Is there anyone opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you very much. Motion passes. Is there any other business to be brought forward to the board? Jeanette, anything else?
No, that covers everything from my perspective, Peter.
All right, thank you. Any board member, any further business? All right, hearing none, I'd take a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you all. The motion carries, and we hopefully will see everyone in March. Thank you.